Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Hey, good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedy is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. If you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or ANJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course, so it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy is in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremedyisinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy is in the Law. And Your Remedy is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you what are your hot points interested in. This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. But if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of what you think of a network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom, it's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number in the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make if your remedy is in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedy is in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you call board and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if we dispose properly and then answer properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, I want to thank you for your disclaimer and
all
your time
right,
that you spent on that.
That is my ramble for this evening, folks. Tonight's speaker
is Mr. Tony Davis. Tony's going to be talking tonight about Title 83, wrapping everything up. And I really think that's because it basically comes out. Am I correct on that, Mr. Davis?
Hold on. Can I be heard? Something's wrong here. Hello, hello. Scott, can you hear me? I unmuted you on my end, I think. Scott.
Yes.
All right, so I can be heard?
Yes, yes, loud and clear.
Okay. All right, very good, thank you. My board is telling me otherwise, so I can't figure that one out. I'm going to go ahead and refresh. Well, listen, thank you so much, Scott. Ladies and gentlemen, let me mute that back again. Tonight, we're going to have John with us. He'll be joining us in about, 10 minutes, maybe 15 minutes, and that's a good thing. I want to open by sharing with you something that I want to be having John cover tonight that I think is very, very important. We start with by saying, and this is the quote that I'm going to have John extrapolate on, someone from the gallery in a observing a trial going on, their hand, and is acknowledged by the judge. And this person sits and says, "Your Honor, permission to approach amicus curiae, friend of the court." Judge says, "That's strange," or something to that effect. "Would it please this honorable court to be made aware of something that could have negative repercussions of a substantial nature upon either the bench or this court?" That's the question. Why is that question asked? Let's talk about cases on jurisdiction. We know from the Monday night call, and basically every other word out of my mouth is about jurisdiction. The jurisdiction is the single tool that basically takes care of almost everything that there is to deal with. So here are some court cases. There's like about a little over half a dozen, maybe a dozen that I'm going to quote to you. And then we'll wrap it up with solutions. Then by that time, prayerfully, John will be here at that time. All right, so cases on jurisdiction. Once jurisdiction is challenged, the court cannot proceed when it clearly appears that the court lacks jurisdiction. The court has no authority to reach merits, but rather should dismiss the action, end quote. This is Mello versus the United States, 505 4 2nd, 10:26. In Hagens versus Levine, 415 U.S. 533, quote, the law requires proof of jurisdiction to appear on the record of the administrative agency and all administrative proceedings, end quote. In U.S. versus Lopez and also Hagens versus Levine, both void because of lack of jurisdiction. In Lopez, the circuit court called it right, and in Hagens, it had to go to the Supreme Court before it could be called right. In both cases, void. In the case of Lopez, it was a jury trial which was declared want of jurisdiction. If it doesn't exist, there can be no conviction or judgment. Without much with powers being the jurisdiction, the state cannot be said to be sovereign. At best, to proceed would be an excess of jurisdiction, which is as well fatal to the states or to the United States cause. In Broome versus Douglas, 75 Alabama 68, the same being jurisdictional facts fatal to the government's cause. In again, we talked about Mello. Well, we already quoted that one. I'm not going to quote it again. After Mello, what do we have? Come on. Here we go. This is Ceramic versus Ceramic, 17 Kansas App 2nd 573. Quote, a judgment rendered by a court without personal jurisdiction over the defendant is void. It's a nullity. A judgment shown to be void for lack of personal service on the defendant is also a nullity. Old Wayne Mutual Association versus McDonough. Quote, a court cannot confer jurisdiction where none existed and cannot make a void proceeding valid. It is clear and well-established law that a void order can be challenged in any court. In Joyce versus the United States, there is no discretion to ignore lack of jurisdiction. Roseman versus Lambert, the burden shifts to the court to prove jurisdiction. In Latana versus Hopper, court must prove on the record all jurisdictional facts related to the jurisdiction asserted. Remember talking about the maxim of law, the one who asserts upon challenge must evidence their assertion, otherwise their assertion is a nullity. So when the police officer turns on his blue lights in your rearview mirror, when somebody, an investigator or a prosecutor, serves a warrant on you, all right, that's all an assertion that you're on the land jurisdiction and that your persona jurisdiction applies to that law. It's asserted, so make them prove it. The law provides that one state and federal jurisdiction has been challenged, it must be proven. Basso versus Utah Power and Light. Jurisdiction can be challenged at any time. Well, what about somebody convicted 20 years ago? It says any time. You can go back today, correct your status today, nunc pro tunc, meaning back to the point of the beginning, and then challenge it. Hilltop Developers versus Holiday Pines Service Corporation. Hey, this is here in Florida. It says defense of lack of jurisdiction over the subject matter may be raised at any time, even on appeal. Lantana versus Hopper. Courts must prove on the record all jurisdictional facts to the jurisdiction asserted. We covered that. Stuck versus Medical Examiners. Once challenged, jurisdiction cannot be assumed. It must be proved to exist. Maine versus Thibodeau. Jurisdiction, once challenged, cannot be assumed and must be decided. Joyce versus U.S. of A. Where there's no jurisdiction on the subject matter, there is, as well, no discretion to ignore the lack of jurisdiction. Roseman versus Lambert. The burden shifts to the court to prove jurisdiction. Again, Lantana versus Hopper, it says, courts must prove on the record all jurisdiction facts related to the jurisdiction asserted. Norwood versus Renfield, a universal principle as old as the law, is that a proceedings of the court without jurisdiction are a nullity, and its judgment therein without effect either on person or property. In application of Wyatt, jurisdiction is fundamental, and a judgment rendered by a court that does not have jurisdiction to hear, it is void, ab initio, meaning to the point of the beginning. Dillon versus Dillon. Thus, where a judicial tribunal has no jurisdiction on the subject matter on which it assumes to act, its proceedings are absolutely void in the fullest sense of the term. Rescue Army versus Municipal Court of Los Angeles. Quote, a court has no jurisdiction to determine its own jurisdiction. Read that again. A court has no jurisdiction to determine its own jurisdiction. For a basic issue in any case before a tribunal is its power to act, and a court must have the authority to decide the question in the first instance. Wow. Wust versus Wust. A departure by a court from those recognized and established requirements of law, however close apparent adherence is to mere form in method of procedure, which has the effect of depriving one of a constitutional right, is an excess of jurisdiction. Merritt versus Hunter. When a court failed to observe safeguards, it amounts to denial of due process of law. Court is deprived of juris standing. Monroe versus Papa. This is the last one. The fact that the petitioner was released on a promise to appear before a magistrate for an arraignment, that fact is circumstance to be considered in determining whether in first instance there was a probable cause for the arrest. All right? So, we go back to the question at hand. Your Honor, permission to approach amicus curiae. Would it please this honorable court to be made aware of something that could have a negative repercussion of a substantial nature upon either the court or the bench? Well, let's look at two more cases, and then we'll look to see if John's here. This is Schur versus Rhodes. Quote, hold on a second. All right, this is Schur versus Rhodes, 416 U.S. 232. This is a 1974 case. The United States Supreme Court held that state officials, so your judge is a state official, the law enforcement officer that gave you the blue light special is a state official, the prosecutor is a state official. They held that state officials acting by color of law may be held personally liable for the injuries or the torts that they cause, and that official or sovereign immunity may not be asserted. And then in Warnick versus Pecos County, Texas, quote, when a state officer acts under a state law in a manner violative of the federal constitution, he comes into conflict with the superior authority of that constitution, and he is in that case stripped of his official or representative character and is subjected in his person to the consequences of his individual conduct. The state has no power to impart to him any immunity from responsibility to the supreme authority of the United States. So, ladies and gentlemen, there's a phrase that I love to hear ring. It's called deprivation of rights under color of law, which happens nearly every time you have intervention with the state or the Fed, either way. So, John's joined us. Hello, John.
Good evening, Michael.
Good evening. You've heard part of what I've talked about. I went through a dozen or more cases with regards to jurisdiction, how it's made void. And then I wrapped it up with remedies that can be applied for those state officials, be they judges or prosecutors or the leos that act as the point of the spear of the state, in the remedies and that are in the law. So it brings us back to the question that you shared with us once or twice before, where the gentleman in the gallery asked permission to approach the bench or to, and the question posited was, would it please this honorable court to be made aware of something that could have negative repercussion of a substantial nature upon either the court or the bench? So what I'd like for you to share tonight, and I know I'm surprising you with this, and I apologize for that, but, you know, if you know your material, you shouldn't have a problem, right, John? So tell me, how is it possible for a judge to have summary execution upon his body for violating your substantive due process, for depriving you of your rights under color of law? How can it lead to his death or her death?
Oh, that's a very, very good point, Michael. The thing that's really important is that the authority to exercise the office that they have comes from an oath of office that they administer, that is administered to them at the time of their election or their assignment of office. And that oath of office to swear and uphold the Constitution is what gives them the power to execute the rights, the authority, the privileges, and amenities of the office of the judiciary. And in Article 3, Section 1 of the Constitution, line 2, it says, the judges, comma, both of the supreme and the inferior courts, comma, shall hold their offices during times of good behavior. There's more to it about pay, but it makes it very, very clear that their office is exclusively contingent on good behavior. They're not allowed to color outside the lines. And to that end, they're not sovereign and they're not God. Many of them, you know, many of us have escalated our egos have escalated our personal consideration to the place where then man made God in his own image. But but the challenge is that under Article 6, Paragraph 3, it states emphatically, the senators and representatives before mentioned and the members of the several state legislatures, comma, and all executed and all executive and judicial officers, both of the United States and the several states. Now, please note here, it says both of the United States and of the several states, indicating that there is two completely different entities. And this is Article 6, Paragraph 3 of the Constitution. We'll go back and catch another one of those in a moment. But both of then that all executive and judicial officers, meaning presidents and governors, etc., every one of us that reaches the place of an elected official is required to be bound, shall be bound by an oath of affirmation to support the Constitution. Okay? Now, that oath of office and affirmation of the Constitution is extremely, extremely critical. Now, if you back up a little bit to Article 4, Section 4, the first sentence, it says, the United States shall guarantee to every state in the Union a Republican form of government. Those people who talk about democracy and the frustrations that democracy is having surviving, and if you look at some newspapers, their website says, and one of the biggest things that's printed on one of them says, democracy dies in darkness. Democracy, where in our founding fathers' documents was the word democracy ever penned in any single document? Quite the opposite. It's we're guaranteed a Republican form of government. Without that, we have no government. But they, they're at this juncture, what it's stating is that the United States, the corporation, and GW makes this point so eloquently that and GW and Michael both make the point so eloquently that there is a big, huge difference. And a couple of the places that describe this is obviously Article 4, Section 4. The United States shall guarantee to every state in the Union a Republican form of government. And the difference between the two is very stark and very significant. And amidst this, it's pointed out that the judiciary, among all of the other executives and senators and representatives, are all required and bound by an oath of office. Now, if that oath of office is not intact, they cannot continue to execute the office of their authority. Now, most judiciary are a teeny wee bit arrogant. There are a few of them. I'll say there is a couple that may be arrogant, and that when it's brought to their attention, their attitude is, "You meaningless little insignificant twit, I will show you." And then they'll grab that handle on the end of that big chunk of wood and slam it on the desk, and they'll just use a word like "remanded," and they will remand you to custody. Michael's point about asking questions in court is very, very important. That, you know, if you go tell a judge, "Hey, look, you just broke your oath of office. You're not allowed to exercise that authority and amenities or privileges of the office. You're done." They will probably snap the gavel and say, "I'll show you." But as Michael so carefully pointed out, raising your hand and say, "Your Honor, request permission to approach amicus curiae." And amicus curiae is the Latin for friend of the court. Usually they ask, "Well, what could you possibly help to?" I always encourage everybody to ask the question first, and always ask the questions. "Your Honor, would it please the Honorable Court to be made aware of something that could be a hazard to the jurist's tenure?" And usually, if I'm going to go into court, I usually do a little look-see up on the background on the judiciary on the bench there. And to that end, you know, finding out how long they've been on the bench is very, very good. But if you ask a question like, "Your Honor, if there was something that could be brought up that could threaten the judiciary's 19 years, 8 months, 3 weeks and 6 days of tenure, and potentially remand the judiciary to the custody, federal custody, that could also carry the death penalty, is that something that the judiciary would like to know?" And I have never had one object to that yes. Now, I say yet, but it could happen. But what's happening is that's very, very important is that you've asked kindly. Now, when they say, "Yes, I would like to know," what happened is that they just bought into your question, and you're supporting your consideration to respond to that question. And you didn't just tell them something, you asked them something. And I've had cases where opposing counsel or district attorney or the deputy attorney general all of a sudden object, "Your Honor," but because it was posed just this way, usually the judiciary will say, excuse me, I asked the question. He's answering my question. And I, and at one time, I even had one justice. She told both the prosecutors, could you guys put a sock in it? I asked him the question. I want an answer. She used the words, can you put a sock in it? And after the second outburst, she asked him, he says, you know, I can find you in contempt. Will you guys want to be quiet, or should I just find you in contempt? I want to hear what he has to say, and I want him to finish. And so, and then, as Michael so carefully pointed out, at this juncture, you can ask them the question, and the question that you might, you know, and it's very important subject that you're working with, that you ask the right question, you know, and the easiest one that to demonstrate this is that, Your Honor, does the Honorable Court, where in the Constitution does it exclude the right to keep and bear a firearm on that school ground or that church or that bank or that bus or this building or let alone your court? This person being charged with that crime, would the Honorable Court also consider it a violation of rights under color of law under 18 U.S.C. 242? And most of the judiciary now are familiar enough with that you can just quote it. But from time to time, I had a student that just 3 months ago, they're a farm family from North Dakota. And when I was a kid, my family's originally from North Dakota. There was times where we used to go to summer school up there, and we used to take the .22 rifle and the .410 shotgun with us to school. And in the back, by the coat rack and everything else of the one-room school around us, there was usually half a dozen or a dozen rifles and shotguns of different various sizes because the kids went hunting on the way home. And my parents, my father was born in 1934, and by 1944, he was carrying both a 20 gauge and a 22 to school with him every single day. And back then, it was still on the heels of the Great Depression, and they were encouraging everybody to remand their children to the state to be raised, you know, and so there was public schoolhouses. Now, back then, the public schoolhouses were funded by the local government. They were not funded by the federal government. But what's happened is that nowadays, when parents want to take advantage of, they say, well, I've got to work, I need somebody to help me with this issue about educating my child, they don't pick up the responsibility and they leave their children to the state, remand their children to the state to be raised. And so by the time the children get into, you know, sixth or eighth grade or 10th grade, that husband and wife, they're not the parents of that child. Axl Rose and Madonna are their parents, you know, and they get frustrated because sometimes the children make decisions that they should or shouldn't, and it's not the child's fault. It's our fault. We're the ones that remanded them to the state to be raised. But what happens is that asking the question, where in the Constitution does it exclude the right to keep and bear their firearm in this schoolroom or this courthouse or your courtroom, Your Honor, it makes a point. You see, that particular subject material, that point that's made very quickly and very eloquently, they're not interested. And when you ask, and does the Honorable Court consider this a deprivation of civil of their rights under color of law under 18 U.S.C. 242, or would the court consider the prosecutors pursuing this a deprivation of civil rights under 18 U.S.C. 241? Because usually about that time, the prosecutors are object, Your Honor. And so, you know, when they start calling down insults and objecting, all I do is raise my hand. I don't forcefully interject myself into the situation, and I don't encourage anybody to forcefully interject, not the way a lot of the prosecutors and et cetera interject themselves. By the time the judge looks around and sees your hand up, he says, oh, did you want to say something? Yes, Your Honor. Would the honorable court consider this under 18 U.S.C. 241, a conspiracy to deprive the civil rights and color of law by the prosecutors and punishable by prison term or potential death penalty? And when usually about that time you ask that, it's a tectonic, emotionally tectonic event, and the judge will go one way or the other very quickly. And usually they go the first way. They'll say, well, Mr. Prosecutor, Madam Prosecutor, are we attempting to deprive him of his right to keep and bear a firearm? And sometimes, you know, they'll go the other way. They'll say, and I've had the very words used in front of me, I could easily have you found in contempt of court and remand you to my marshal's jail. And now, if you're going to seek to support your civil rights, it's very, very important that you take with you somebody that's capable of doing so. Now, all through the 80s and 90s, I had the honor and privilege of knowing, and in 1990, I moved from California to Texas, and I had the honor and privilege of knowing some U.S. Marshals that I like to call them John Waynes. And what it is that no matter what happened, no matter what sliced out from the in front of them, even if their boss says, hey, look, you got to do this, they would say, excuse me, that's a deprivation of civil rights under color, or somebody's rights under color of law, and you just committed a felony. They would. I actually had the honor and privilege of knowing more than one federal marshal that would arrest his own boss. And but we go into court, you know, and I have these little plastic coated cue cards, and I make these up specific to the case at hand. It has 18 U.S.C. 241 and 242 on there, and the question: where in the Constitution is who the right to bear a firearm in this court? And the related penalties, and also U.S. Marshals will moonlight just like regular peace officers moonlight. And sometimes they're kind of expensive. And the two that I used to like to use the most were they were $2.75 an hour. And but I used to pay the $2,200 to have them both for $2,200 to have them both for 4 hours, 2 hours of briefing time and 2 hours of court time. And I told them, if we're done in 30 minutes, you still keep 2 hours, that we pay a minimum of 2 hours. And if there's more, then we pay more. And this includes the time that you're just sitting there listening to the other cases. You're being paid $2.75 an hour. They're very pleased with that. That's what I used to pay all the way back to the 80s. I've always made certain that it was something satisfactory for them, to the risk that they're going to make a stench, their person's stench in the nose of the judge. So to that end, they better be something, a carrot there that's good enough for them to do that. But and sometimes when the judge goes the other way and says, well, I could find you, says, Your Honor, do you think a U.S. Marshal would allow you to commit a felony in front of them without detaining you? And they'll say, there's no U.S. Marshal here. And that's invariably the question that gets immediately asked. And then one time, actually more than one time, I've had this this happen. I says, would the U.S. Marshal please stand up? And all of a sudden, the U.S. Marshal stands up, and it's not one that I brought with me. And one time I says, not that U.S. Marshal, the other U.S. Marshal. And another one stands up, and it's not one of the either of the two that I brought with me. And I says, not that U.S. Marshal, the other one. And then the two that I brought with me stood up. Turns out they were talking to some friends in the hallway and downstairs in the break room. And they explained that, hey, there's this lunatic that hired them for 4 hours, and we're going to go watch the judge, you know, the lions eat the lunatic in the circus. Well, they shared their little cue cards with them, and they came up, and they all of a sudden about this time, the judge is standing there with his jaw laying on the ground, and I never realized there was so just poor dental hygiene amongst the judiciary. All of his teeth were laying on the ground, you know, and the prosecutor was objecting, and in this one particular case, the judge says, you know what, I could summarily dismiss this case, but if the prosecutor just was to dismiss it, then these fine young gentlemen would have no, one of them was 68 years old at the time, they would have no judicial standing to arrest you. But if I dismiss it summarily, they've still got judicial standing to arrest the prosecutors. And about that time, the prosecution stops objecting and says, does the state have a motion? And, Your Honor, but no, does the state have a motion to dismiss? Says it's probably in your best interest for you guys to dismiss it rather than me. Grumble, grumble, grumble. Oh, okay, Your Honor, I guess the state moves to dismiss. And I asked on all counts, and this was a 63-year-old school teacher, elementary school teacher, that was being charged with wrongful carry of a firearm, and this is here in the Houston area, unlawful carry of a firearm on school ground. They charged her with multiple felonies. And I says, you know, do we, can we dismiss this, you know, if we're going to dismiss this, is we dismissing it on all accounts? And they agreed to all accounts, and I turned to the school teacher, and I looked at her, and I'm just almost nose to nose, not quite that close, but I'm just saying, I told her, I whispered, and I says, nod your head up and down, and side to side, you know, nod up and down, now side to side, now up and down. And I says, Your Honor, the school teacher has agreed not to file a criminal grand theft firearm charges against the four police officers that made the arrest, both prosecutors here, and this court, if she has her firearm back within the next 60 minutes. And the prosecutor should object. You know, Your Honor, their process, it has to be processed out. There's paperwork to do, you know. And, I turned around and looked at her, and I says, not up and down, and then now not side to side. I says, Your Honor, she's advised me they have 59 minutes, and that she will be seeking the death penalty because she was injured. She was incarcerated. There's no, and they objected. So she was in jail. They objected. I says, Your Honor, what's the statute for wrongful arrest? He says, oh, that's easy. There isn't one. And I says, exactly. It's kidnapping under color of law. And the moment everybody heard that, they had a different tone. But suffice to say, one of the clerks tossed her keys to one of the prosecutors and said, here, here's the keys to my car. It's in the parking lot. For a thing, I just looked it up. It's in the sheriff's jail, in the evidence locker under this number, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And clerk had the judge quick sign a release of property from the et cetera. And turns out that the person that took, borrowed the car keys didn't actually drive over. Turns out the sheriff's property office was just a couple of blocks away, and she ran. And with 12 minutes to spare, had not just the guns, but the bullets right there. And as she got ready to leave, judge says, wait a minute, I got to give you a court order. He says, what do you mean? Well, I don't want you getting arrested walking out of the building with a gun and live ammunition. And the judge just made an order. And right there, it's the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear a firearm shall not be infringed, was fully enforced. Now, something that's very, very important is that when you it's Marbury versus Madison, 137, 153, first branch, 137, second branch, 238. And there's the thing that's really important is that on the first branch, the second to the last paragraph in the opinion of Marbury versus Madison, it says, thus the particular phraseology of the Constitution of the United States confirms and strengthens the principle supposed to be essential that all written constitutions, that a law repugnant to the Constitution is void, and that courts as well as departments are bound by that instrument. Okay? The rule must be discharged. And that's Marbury versus Madison, 1803. You can look it up. There's no, it's not hard to find. There's, it's actually quite the opposite, quite easy to find. But look at, just scroll down to the last, second to last paragraph. And you can see that opinion. So that any time on any specific topic when they're violating your rights under color of law, policy or procedure, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that is very, very important that it says whoever under color of law, statute, ordinance, regulation, or custom willfully suggests a person or a state, territory, commonwealth, possession, or district to any deprivation of rights or privileges or immunities secured or protected by the Constitution or laws of the United States. Okay? And it covers, and it's very clear here, to any territory, state, commonwealth, possession, or district. And this is indicating, going back to what GW says, you know, that there is very, very specific indication, even in the opinions of the courts that did, that succeeded and are under establishment of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, they still recognize the difference between the United States and the several states, between the different states, territories, and commonwealth possessions. So, as I close this, just note that there's an old saying, it says you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. Very, very important. Be a student of law. There's a good reason to do that. It's so that you know where you stand. And if you can do it, just because a jurist wears a gown and swings a gavel, yields a gavel, or a uniform has a badge, you know, and a firearm with it, they've stepped up with honorable consideration, and honorable consideration has to be assumed so that you don't accidentally disrespect the office for the individual that may be abusing the office. If somebody's abusing the office and their authority, it's not the office's fault, it's the individual's fault. And to that end, as Michael pointed out, the individuals are subject to individual prosecution. Because now, once they've violated their oath of office and they've stepped outside of that, they're operating on their own. Thank you, Michael.
Well, thank you. before we get into the Q&A mode, which was for two, I'd like to invite a caller from Roseville, California. Phone number ending in 4212. If you'd be so kind as to say hello and share your first name and tell us how you arrived on this call tonight.
Hello, my name's Mike, and I was working with JW. He helped me become a national and invited me on this call.
Oh, wonderful. You travel good circles.
That's what I hear.
Thank you so much. All right. The purpose for the Tuesday night call is basically twofold. One, to hammer home, if you would, the very reason that we have our new guest here tonight, Mike, from the Monday night call about the importance of correcting your status. And then the second purpose for the call is where I put on my checkered jacket and my striped slacks and my straw hat, get that skanky cigar in my mouth and that walking stick cane, and I start baiting the table, telling you to come on in and see this oddity we've got here in this tent, you know, from the carnival days. It's my job to market the talents of the information providers that we have. And what I want you to hear when you listen to John is that John is the point of the spear of the team. The team is GW, it's Bernie, it's Chris Ann, it's, well, that's first string, if you would. Second string, we've got Raven and a fellow named Jim and a few others, a handful of other people. Now, the reason why we have first string and second string is because I have what I call the 100-year plan. Sometimes I get asked from very thoughtful people, well, if I come into this and you're teaching me and somebody dies or they quit on you, whatever, what happens? Well, what happens is that we have from the first string is responsible for teaching and bringing on the second string. People who already are in their own right would be first string if the people that I have on first string weren't available. It's so you have a solution to basically any and every legal situation that you have. Now, the relationship is always student-teacher. It must be student-teacher. No one here, as you know, on the disclaimer that we run for 13 minutes before the call actually starts, no one here is an attorney, a lawyer, or a member of the bar. No one here is able to give legal advice without committing something called practicing law without a license, which incidentally, curiously, is meant for attorneys who have been disbarred but yet continue to promote themselves as attorneys, as members of the bar. That's exactly what practicing law without a license is. It has nothing to do with the work that, in any other manner, that Bernie or GW or John or any of the other people do. So it's just, stay safer, we just simply have a student-teacher relationship. And in that relationship, you basically have unlimited hours to make certain, know the material that you need to deal with at that point in time in your education when you will be appearing in court or doing whatever it is that you must do to defend yourselves. And the written material that is supplied to you is your teaching syllabus. It's written material that you are to learn and study. That some students have said, well, you know, this looks so good the way it is, I'd like to just file it in the court. And you know, the teacher will sit there and say, well, that's your business, what you do with it. I'm just here to teach you. We want to make certain that we never get to that place where we have to deal with something that we can avoid dealing with if it's possible. So that's the primary purpose for Tuesday's call. So with that having been said, Press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen. Press star 2 to raise your hand, ask your questions. Those of you on Freedom's Radio, you'll see a place on the center right of your monitor. It's a silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side. If you'd be so kind as to click inside of your comment to your question, I'll be very happy to give voice, and John will respond, and we'll go from there. So press star 2 in your keypad. Now, the other side of the coin is if nobody asks questions and gets the ball rolling, we'll have a very early call tonight, and John won't be happy with me at all because he wants to have questions and answers, which I don't blame him. Press star 2 on your keypad, or we're going to go home. There we go. Well, Mike, brave guy, thank you. Welcome.
Yeah, so who would be the best instructor to help me out with getting some personal loans and credit card debt offset?
Well, you use the word offset. John, would you like to talk about offset versus challenging the material itself? Offset suggests, you know, using like the SESTK trust and things like that.
Well, there, the credit card debt, I don't really use the term offset. There's a reason. It's because when you get the offset, they like to file a 1040 with the IRS that you've technically, when we've got the debt resolved, that they say that you have earned income, excuse me. Credit cards debt, getting it offset or getting it resolved, is a function of a handful of things. One of the biggest is that the credit card debt, the actual credit card debt, they like to collateralize it and securitize it. And this is something that most people don't understand. And what happens is that once the debt is collateralized or securitized, that individual is no longer that bank card or this bank or this credit company is no longer technically the holder of that debt. And there's a handful of things that come into play that they're required to do that very few of them actually even do. That there's 12 U.S.C. 2605 as defined under 12 U.S.C. 2602 where they're required to make certain filings so that you have a right to know who you owe and how much you owe. And to that end, a lot of times just asking that question of a credit card provider, they already know that they've collateralized it, and it's even pool collateralized, and that they haven't complied with those issues. So they'll do one of two things: either one, ignore your question, or number two, start to threaten you. Those are the two primary responses. There is a third response, and I've had individuals just flat out send a zero balance invoice and the credit card debt is gone because they're not interested in going to jail because they haven't complied with some of the minutiae of the little filings that they have that they're required by federal law to maintain so that they can continue to do the business the way they want to. Before the FRB contract expired in 2013, the Federal Reserve Board, there was something called fractionalized banking, meaning that if you had a dollar worth of assets that were that were in for you, that were on deposit with you, that you could loan up to $10. And the Federal Reserve Bank, if you remember, also the FDIC, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and that's what that is. It's a corporation that works with the Federal Reserve. But they would arrange to allow your bottom line to mark up to up to 10 times 1,000% of what you had on deposit to that, so that you could lend that out. And what happens is the credit card debts and the mortgage banking debts alike, the two have a teeny weeny bit in common. That was collateralized, and they began to make money off of you. And this is how these little banks, so many little banks show up on almost every street corner. This was how they began to do that. And then when the Federal Reserve Bank contract expired, they still kept on doing it. And there's, to this day, they're still doing it. And what's happened is that it's not quite the it's not quite legal. Before, it was definitely wrong, but it was made legal. Now it's not quite legal. And so a lot of times, banks, if you question, say, hey, look, and I have a pretty much a standard direction that I take, although I do not have a form letter and I will not boilerplate a letter or an inquiry to anybody, whether it's the Treasury Department, IRS, or credit card company or whatever. I do not boilerplate anything, because these guys are not dumb. If they start to see the same material coming over exactly the same way from multiple different people, they can connect the dots and figure out where everything's coming from. And they'll eventually, take action to try to create a different path, or to eliminate this path to resolving that debt. Also, anytime you boilerplate, there's always something that doesn't quite fit. And these guys, let's face it, if I thought that I was the sharpest pencil in the box, I would be highly mistaken. There'd be a gross, wrong statement based on my ego. And what happens is that my ego would have just wrote a check that my butt couldn't cash. Okay? And so it's very, very important that we don't let our egos start writing checks our butt can't cash. And to that end, when we're bringing up these issues with our banks and our credit cards, it's very important that you understand how the banking system does work, so that you can look at the inequities that they may have over and the things that they've overlooked, and get your credit card debt washed away. This is what I've stated is not even a 40,000 foot view. It's an 80 or 120,000 foot view. The specifics that it takes to go through that are a teeny bit extensive. Does this help at all?
It does. Thank you.
All right. I want to add to what John just spoke about. He mentioned about the fact that the attorneys who are there to, quote, collect the debt, end quote, cross all their I's and dot all their T's. We got it backwards, right? And I did it on purpose, because these people, they dot their T's and cross their I's. The point being is that there is a former information provider. He's now retired. His name is Mike also. And Mike has a package that he allows us to continue to sell for him. The package is $600. If you are not in litigation yet, in other words, you're still dealing with threatening letters and things like that, there are violations. There's three primary violations that you can deal with by following the very clear instructions that are in this package. It's the Fair Debt, violating the Fair Debt Collections Practices Act. It's violating the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and it's violating the Telephone Protection Act. Once you set off, send off registered mail, return receipt, green card, you know that one. Once you send that off, they have to stop all activity in collecting the debt. They have to notify the credit bureau companies that the debt is in dispute. They never do. And they must respond to that letter, and basically it's called prove up the claim. They have to prove, evidence you what they are going to go into court with that demonstrates that it's a bona fide debt. They can't do it. They never can do it. Point being, though, is that if you're still in the administrative process, this $600 package can stop things cold. It can set a record in place so that 8 months later, 10 months later, you're suing in federal court for these three violations. You've got a perfect record that you've been shown how to keep in that that package. And when you go to court, federal court is way, way different than state court or city county courts. It's way different. It's you can go to sometimes go to federal court, and if it's close to tea time or lunchtime or whatever, you may even find the judge to say, let's come in the chambers and we'll talk, we'll do it there, instead of formally with his robe on in the bench, at the bench. And he'll turn to the defendant, that's the guy you're suing, the debt collector, and say something like, what do you have to say about this complaint? And the debt collector will typically say something like, Your Honor, this is just a sham proceeding. The plaintiff owes my client X amount of dollars, and he's just using this to delay the inevitable of paying. And, you know, he'll go on for a few minutes, and the judge says, okay, I see. And then he'll turn to you, and you'll sit there and say, Your Honor, I'm really confused. I thought that the defendant was an attorney, knowledgeable in the law. I don't think he even read the complaint. We're here not on any purported debt. We're here on violations of the Fair Debt Collections Practices Act, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and the Telephone Protection Act. And as you can see in this filing that I gave you, this is evidence that I have of every one of these violations that have occurred over the last 8 months, 10 months. Judge looks over things and then turns to the defendant and says something like, and this is lawyer talk, this is real important lawyer talk, maybe John will share what it means. He'll tell the defendant, the two of you might want to step outside, we're going to recess for 10 minutes, and you might want to see if you can negotiate something between yourselves that you find fair and equitable. And we'll recess for 10 minutes and see you back in here. John, what does that mean?
The biggest problem about this is that judges know that they have a job as long as there's a conflict. Some things they would rather not let it get raised to the point where they have to make a decision, because it does affect their bottom line. And the other thing is that if they have to make a decision, it can be codified into law eventually, so that the need for them goes away. At that juncture, it's usually the judge saying, look, paraphrased in the, and I'll paraphrase this in abusive terms. Look, you silly goose. This guy is about to bring up what you're, that you screwed up and that you could be going to jail. You should shut your mouth and open your ears and listen to him for a few moments. And maybe, it's best if you just wave off on this debt, because this guy's gonna, push, this looks like this guy's got enough attitude to push this, and you'll go to jail, and I'll be the one that'll have to send you. So he gets, the judge is quietly encouraging him towards some right thinking.
Correct. He's just informing the defendant that he's going to rule against him and do what you can. And we have further discussion on that as well. So we'll cover that. Anyways, that's what I wanted to share with you, Mike.
I appreciate it. And is this the Michael J. Miras, the $600 package?
It's Mike. It's just Mike.
Okay.
We'll talk later on it. All right. Thank you. Any other questions, Mike?
No, that's it.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. And next, hey, it's another Mike, only this time it's Michael from Las Wages, Nevada.
Well, good evening. Anyway, he mentioned the word cess decay, the trust, the money. Everybody wants the money. But what I'd like to know is how you get the record of what they've done with the money and who has signed off on the money and under what law are they operating to do that without full disclosure for the beneficiary?
That right now, because most of these financial institutions, whether they're credit card or banking or mortgage, et cetera, because they usually pool the debts, that's a little bit tough to get all of that. If you can sometimes show that the money went one place, and they failed to file like the 2602 or 2605 filing, then there's times when bank vice presidents, usually about that level, make decisions to just wash away the debt. And as Michael carefully pointed out, there's a lot of things you can do before it gets to the litigious state that if you've got some tall revolving plastic or whatever it is, that if you decide you want to stop and live debt-free and stop being a slave to their system and paying their daily usury. There's ways to get that stopped very, very quickly, and that package is one.
Okay.
Right, and the reason I brought up the $600 package is because that's a lot less expensive than it is to hire the team to come in and clean things up for you. So that's what I want to share. Anything else, Michael?
No, that's it. I've got the package for my daughter. I sent her the money to get the package, so she's studying it.
Yep.
And we'll proceed from there.
Very good. And I have familiarity with it to a degree, and I can help you as well.
All right. Thank you.
Harold is next. Go ahead, Harold.
Hi, Michael. I don't know if this is a question for tonight or for Monday night. If it's for Monday night, then I'll just call it back in again. My question is from last night. What is the difference between an elector and a voter?
I think John actually can answer that. Can you?
The electors are individuals that have been put in place by the voters to make their choice known in specific cases of how our government functions. The one that's most common that everybody remembers the most is the presidential election. And up until 1933, those of us who are over 23 may remember that our grandparents talked about there was times when there were two ballots at the voting box. One was for everyone, landowners and residents. The other was for landowners only. And what happened was, as part of the aggregate constitution, if you owned land, you were allowed to vote for senators and the respective elector. In the, with respect to just being a resident, you were only allowed to vote for representatives. And so what's happened is that the electors themselves are the ones that vote in the Electoral College for the president. A voter is an individual who votes for the elector that sets, also sets the popular vote to indicate how they want the elector to vote. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. Okay, so what is the, based on what I heard Monday night, it says if you're a land owner, and they were debating on, you know, how much, to what degree a landowner means, but if you're a landowner, you became an elector. Are you, did that mean you got an elector just like they were voting for you as an elector, or that just you got to vote for who you want to be an elector?
The latter. It's a, you have a say-so in who becomes an elector. Actually, it's not necessarily just the elector. It's what the elector says and votes on their plate.
Okay.
Now, something very interesting occurred in 1933 and the years following. Social Security Act, several other taxing type acts came into play. In 1940, the Buck Act came into play. The Internal Revenue Service, again, had an update in their rules in that interim period of time. Confusion ran so much that in 1945, the question again arose, what is the definition of United States in what's called the Hooven decision? It had already been asked in 1901 with the Bidwell decision because of the efforts prior to the IRS, the Jekyll Island thing. Anyways, prior to that, you know, there were already moves in the 1880s and 1890s to have a national income tax or an internal revenue service of sorts, if you would, that was already in play. So in the 1930s, from the 1880s to the 1930s, that was all of these moves taking you towards that. 1933 is when the fit hit the shan, if you would. And from that point forward, hold on a second, please. The real activity began to take place to shore up and to unteach and reteach people to lose the republic, if you would, and focus on the democracy. That's when everything really kicked in for that. Now, what was the Buck Act? Well, the Buck Act was also part of creating territories for the United States that were layered, if you would, on top of the real states of the Union. And you know, for instance, you've heard me on the calls. You have Florida, which is to the Union, which is organized with other states by and under the Constitution. And then you have the state of Florida, which is a territory of the United States. Okay? So the Buck Act allowed that to come into play.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay, Harold, thank you. And next and last will be Jennifer, and then we'll say goodnight to John. Go ahead, Jennifer.
Oh, I've forgotten what I was going to ask.
Oh, it's hell getting old, isn't it?
Oh, my God. The first thing that goes, Jennifer, it's murder term 23. I don't know what I'm going to do when I hit 26, but after 23, it's over the hill.
Oh, well. Oh,
Is that, is that like I forgot I had a bad memory? Or I forgot to take my memory medication?
I wish there was such a thing. Anyway, sorry. Next person. Thank you.
No problem. I want to thank everyone for joining us this evening. John, do you have any farewell statements?
1933 is a very interesting year. I won't say it was a good year, but as when they talk about vintages of bubbly and a grape. But one of these weeks we're going to do a call just exclusively on 1933. And some of you might be a teeny bit shocked. Others, it might curl your teeth how significant 1933 was.
Yeah, criminal. All right, John, just as a heads up, I'll be calling you right back because you have one of your students that needs to spend 5 or 10 minutes with you on something.
Roger that. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you all for joining us this evening. Remember to come back next week as well. Tell your friends, please. The Tuesday calls are the lightest calls that we have, and it's actually it's one of the most important because it takes Bernie's Saturday call and GW's Monday call, and it kind of wraps it all up into one bundle that brings everything home. And it gives you, you know, that 40,000 or the 100,000-foot view needed and the remedies you want. So until next week, good night, everybody, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.